Welcome to the annual budget hearings for the City and County of Denver's next fiscal year. This session of the annual budget hearings begins now.
Sponsors from that short break. I'm just kidding. So thank you so much, everyone. We're going to get started on our final rounds of briefings. And next up, we have the Denver Police Department. We have Chief Ron Thomas joining us today to walk us through a presentation. And then we'll have time for questions from council members. So Chief, go ahead and take it away.
Well, thank you. And first, I want to just thank everyone for their attention and certainly appreciate everyone's diligence and thoughtfulness through this process. As you see, here's our page, and we're hoping to really reintroduce everyone to our mission statement, which notes our two main focuses, which are preventing crime and increasing trust. Next is our strategic plan, which again highlights our focus on preventing crime and increasing public trust, which we seek to accomplish through precision policing and innovative training, all while building a more efficient and resilient organization. Our key indicators here are crime severity, community perception of safety, community trust in police, police legitimacy, and the health of the organization. Next are some City Council priorities, first being strengthening community safety by engaging directly with neighborhoods and ensure investment in community-supported anti-racist public health strategies. We believe that we support this through a significant number of engagement events coupled with trust patrols, which are positive community engagement, community building interactions between our officers and community, both at neighborhood locations and businesses. And we also are partnering with DEPHE on a group violence reduction strategy, which I think is looking at things through a lens. And then empowering the community and improving customer service by sharing information, engaging and collaborating with residents. We believe we support this through our attendance at the multiple town halls, our own community advisory group meetings, regular attendance at registered neighborhood organization meetings. Our customer service is actually measured by a survey tool that I can talk about later. And also we have a transparency dashboard. Many of the things that are on that dashboard are actually informed by community. Next are our agency priorities, which you'll see are aligned with some city priorities. First being group violence reduction, which is a multidisciplinary effort involving us, DDPG, OCI, and it's just coordinating violence prevention efforts aimed at those that are identified at risk of being convicted or suspect of gun violence, and then providing them high quality outreach and services based on their needs. There's actually a lot of empirical evidence on the effectiveness of the strategy, both from Boston and Dallas and other major cities. Also, use of force of decision making training. So we've already addressed some of the challenges that we have experienced in the past with protest and crowd control. And now we want to work to improve our use of force decision making through an intensive in-person program designed to build resiliency into force decisions and enhance the retention and transfer of skills. And then specific to the Vibrant Denver goal, we want residents and visitors to Denver to know that downtown is a safe place to spend time and continue working through the P&I board to make changes to both nightlife and transit infrastructure to limit the potential for violence, also testing deployment strategies aimed at enhancing safety. Quickly, here's our agency structure. You'll see that the department is divided into three divisions, the first being the patrol division, which holds the majority of our force. Next is police investigation, which houses our major crime, special operations, and our strategic investigations personnel. And then our administrative division, which holds most of our professional staff positions, our academy recruits, and then our airport division police, which you'll see is actually supported by the special revenue fund. Next, some key strategic metrics, the first being crime reduction. You see here a reduction in Part 1 crimes. Part 1 crimes, just to reiterate everyone, those are the serious crimes, homicide, assault, robbery, burglary, larceny, auto theft. See a reduction here. I think that is thanks in part to some strategic initiatives focusing on specific crime types such as gun violence and auto theft. Next, we have 911 calls for service. Again, you'll see a reduction there. I think that this signals improved community safety, demonstrated by fewer crimes occurring, and also effective crime prevention. Next is a pretty drastic reduction in gun crime. So we're on pace to actually have the lowest rate of violent gun crime since 2021. Currently seeing about a 13% reduction compared to last year, about a 20% reduction when compared to 2022. We've actually seen a 20% reduction in homicides using firearms and a 30% reduction in non-fatal shootings. I think these achievements are moving us toward our goal of reducing gun crime by 20%, which is our mayoral priority this year. And also, I think, goes toward creating a safer Denver. We have been using a three-part strategy to address the gun crimes. The short term is sort of our hot streets initiative, in which we identify a street that has a high propensity of gun violence. And then we identify specific patrol tactics. It could be lighted patrols. It could be checking in on businesses. They're very, I think, detailed to the specific problem that we've identified in that in the particular street segment. And what we have seen is about an 80% reduction in crime in that particular street segment when we use that particular strategy. Midterm is our group violence reduction, which again is a people-focused approach designed to identify those that are at the highest levels of propensity for being either a victim or a suspect in gun crime, and then getting them connected to high-level services. And then our long-term strategy is police network investigations, which I think most of you are quite familiar. Next is our reductions in motor vehicle theft. You'll see that we had over 15,000 cars stolen in 2022. We reduced that to just over 12,000 in 2023, so that's an 18% reduction. Year to date, we had less than 6,000 cars stolen, and we are on pace to have fewer than 9,000 cars stolen. And that would be about a 29% reduction compared to last year, and then about a 60% reduction if you compare it to 2022. And I attribute that success to the creation of our Denver Auto Theft Team, which has done some tremendous work, as well as the installation of the LPR network throughout the city. Next is response time. So you will see that our response times have increased. On average, from January through August, our response time is about 14 minutes and 48 seconds. And you probably are asking yourselves the question, well, why, if calls for service are going down, if reported crimes are going down, why is response times going up? And I would say that the answer to that is that the complexity of calls is increasing. And so, what that means to me is, we just have calls that I think are taking a much longer time to process. And so one of the few crime categories that's actually increased is domestic violence. Domestic violence happens to be one of the most time-intensive calls for service that we have. Also, there's a lot of digital evidence that we have the opportunity to collect now. So in the past, where we might have an officer to respond in a burglary and just do a quick neighborhood survey, and now they are looking for and identifying ring cameras and collecting that digital evidence. So that's taking additional time. There's been a marked increase in translation services being used, and so I think that also increases the complexity and the length of time that calls for service are taking, so that it's taking longer for officers to get back in service. And really, at the end of the day, our focus is on customer service and doing the job right. And so rather than having them do the job faster, we need to look at ways to, take things off of their plate, kind of reduce their workload. So things that are already in the works there are directing far more calls for service to our online platform, building up our telephone reporting unit, which has been in existence, but now we are connecting them with district clerks so that they can increase their capacity to take calls over the phone and not have to wait for officers to respond. We also are looking at ways to use drones as first responders, so using drones to respond to calls and maybe even identify that there's more need for police response, or at least being able to manage that police response, identifying that maybe rather than taking four or five officers to manage an incident, it only maybe takes one. Among some other strategies that we're contemplating, we are working with Excise and License to look at ways to reduce false alarm response. We're looking at about a 50% reduction if our plans are successful. And that's one of our higher call volumes is silent alarms.
Chief, I'm just going to stop this for a brief moment. If you could just maybe speak up a little bit. It sounds like folks might be having a hard time hearing on Channel 8 and online. Thank you.
All right. So I talked about our customer service metrics. So Spider Tech is the tool that we use to measure that. And essentially what Spider Tech is, it's a technology that whenever you call 911, if you call 911 from a cell phone, which I think most people do, it captures that cell phone number and sends you back a survey. It actually sends you back a number of surveys so that you can report back on the level of service of the call taker as well as the officer who responded. And as you can see, 89% of respondents are reporting being satisfied or very satisfied with the conduct of the officers, which I think is a credit to the high quality training and professionalism of our staff that we expect. Some slides on addressing inequities. First, I want to talk about our police network investigations. As you can see here, five neighborhoods identified. These are all historically underserved neighborhoods, and as you can see, pretty significant reductions in shootings. We started this program in earnest in April of 2024, recognizing this was kind of the key delivery mechanism for the Safe City goal. Across all of the sites, we have about a 39% decrease in gun violence. And then if you compare that to the citywide reduction of about 17%, these particular sites are actually outpacing the performance citywide. So we're actually seeing greater reductions in these neighborhoods than we're seeing throughout the rest of the city. Also, DPD leads the effort to invest in both activations and permanent infrastructure enhancements at each location. And we are leveraging all of the city agencies to kind of pitch in at each of these sites, and HRCP and OSCI are leading the efforts to design how to transition these to less law enforcement centric approaches. Next is trust patrols. So the purpose of trust patrols is to provide Denver communities with a visible, proactive, and reassuring presence within their neighborhoods to continue building and reinforcing trust between officers and the community. You can see already we've done over 260. We're projected to do 400 for the year. We have rolled this out in sort of a three-phase plan, the first being legacy businesses, the second being locations identified by the district commander, the third being locations identified by city council, and we also have a trust partner enrollment system through the DPD website. The idea here is to build a portfolio of locations officers can stop by when they have discretionary time. Next, addressing inequities as it relates to recruiting and retention. As you can see here, a number of initiatives, many of them specifically related to the recruitment and the retention of women. The 30 by 30 initiative, we have held a number of women's academies. We are just now starting a program called Empower Her. So recognize the pun there. And this is actually a 5-week program where every Friday we have women coming and sort of getting immersed in all of the inner workings of the Denver Police Department. And we find this to be rather effective. We find that they are able to, one, identify that there's quite the support system here in Denver. There are unlimited opportunities here in Denver, seeing that there are women at all ranks and in all assignments throughout the department. And the result of that has been 25 to 30% of all of our classes in 2023 and 2024 have been women. We also are holding a number of cultural academies, and you see listed there some community events. And the reason why I list those is because I think that every community event has the opportunity to be a recruiting event, because I think it shows investment. Strategic focus on LODO is next. We're on pace to have the safest LODO in about 5 years. This is a clear indication that the nightlife in downtown Denver is vibrant and that residents can expect a safer experience. There's been a 21% reduction in violent gun crime. We have recovered 50 guns, and we are currently partnering with multiple city agencies to develop exclusionary zones for both ride shares and food trucks, which have been successful in reducing outcrowd time about 30 or 40 minutes, which I think lessens the opportunity for violent incidents to erupt. We're also looking at adjusting deployment strategies for Union Station as well as the Central Business District. So this is our budget composition by fund. As you'll see, the bulk of our fund comes bulk of it comes from the general fund, the lion's share of that being from patrol. A much smaller amount coming from special revenue funds, and that is to support airport police as well as our police pension, and then about $3 million in grants. Next is our general fund's revenue and FTEs. As you can see, there's just an incremental increase in expenditures, a sizable drop in unlimited FTEs, and those are professional staff positions, and a slight bump in revenue coming from increases to in charges for services. Next is budget composition by account category. And as you see, $311 million of our nearly $330 million base is a personnel cost, which amounts to more than 94% of our total budget. Now here are our change summary. At the top, our largest reduction, which is the relinquishment of some uniform vacancy savings. Next is savings from a whole lot of vacant professional staff positions. These are all non-front facing positions, so there will be no impact felt by the community. Following that is a reduction in supplies and services, which again may have behind the scenes impact, but none that are community facing. Next, we have expenses related to the addition of new recruits. We're targeting 168 additional officers, understanding that 40 of those will be funded by DEN through the Special Revenue Fund. After that, we have the addition of 3 community engagement program managers. I think a number of you recall In 2023, we hired three of these as kind of a test for proof of concept. I think many of you probably know who the community engagement program manager is in your respective district and understand that they're doing a phenomenal job. And lastly, funding to continue our license plate reader program, which has already proven quite valuable in our efforts to address crime. Results are currently available on our dashboard. And just to highlight, we've recovered nearly 100 stolen cars and brought quite a few suspects of crime to justice that are accused of violent crimes. Here is our staffing optimization chart with the three classes in 2025, totaling 168 officers. That will help us inch closer to our authorized strict number and overcome attrition by the end of the year. I will call attention to the fact that our attrition rate is declining. We were at nearly 10% retention, and we're less than 5% currently. But what I think we need to pay attention to is the fact that due to the rule of 80, there's about 300 officers that are retirement eligible. I certainly don't anticipate them all leaving at once, but I think we need to be cognizant of that fact. Next, I just want to talk about our community engagement program managers. Again, this demonstrates how valuable they have been. They have more than doubled already this year. The amount of community engagement events that we have done. And that is with those three sharing the workload across all six districts. This, you know, shows our significantly high clearance rate for homicides, which you'll see is well above the national average. And this is always seen as a metric that demonstrates community trust. Getting close to the end, strategies for mitigating the impacts of our 2025 reductions in personnel. Obviously, graduating new officers will help fill ongoing vacancies and outpace attrition. Also, because our professional staff positions play crucial roles in supporting operations, we will need to prioritize where and how these limited resources are deployed to best minimize delays and impacts to processes affecting the community. We'll also need to be frugal with our supplies and services to absorb 3% reduction without any front-facing impact. And then lastly, just to talk about just looking back at how we supported the TRUA budget amendment. Again, that was through a 3% decrease in our supplies and services. That we were able to meet, and just by being more frugal about having this impact. And with that, I'll open it up to questions.
Great. Thank you, Chief. So we have quite a few folks in the queue here. I'll just remind everybody again, please submit any unanswered or additional questions you may have to Angela by Monday. And with that said, I think I will do, because I could see us going down the rabbit hole, so I'm going to keep us with two questions per member, and we can jump back in the queue. So starting us off is Councilman Flynn, followed by Councilman Cashman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chief, on I forget what slide it was, but the crime figures show, compared to 2019, the last year before COVID disruption, crime and the projected crime at the end of the, there it is, at the end of this year is up 35% over 2019. I did the math, so I can't vouch for it. And crimes against persons is up in 2024, estimated by the end of the year, up 22% over 2019, and property crimes up 38%. Are there budget, and I'm sticking to the topic here, are there budgetary solutions to keeping, to getting those numbers of crimes against persons, against property, down to 2019 levels? Things that we can do budgetarily that would help you address that?
Well, you know, I mean, I hate to say that more officers will certainly be helpful, but I think really the way home there is just by our strategic focus on certain crime types. Obviously, you've seen auto thefts. non-fatal shootings go down significantly. So I think that as we put our heads together and focus on some of these specific crime types and work with the community in order to identify solutions, I think that we can continue to see us get to pre-pandemic levels.
Thank you. My second item, and I'll follow up with Angela for other questions, but from a data standpoint, can you break down for us, or can your analysts break down for us, the 911 response time to priority 0 to 2 calls by police district? I know you don't have that off the top of your head.
I can. So the answer to that is yes. And just to provide some further clarity there, obviously, like a priority 0, priority 1, those are like life safety situations. Yes. Obviously, 0 to 2, all of those are like in progress crimes. Priority 0, priority 1s being the most serious, life safety challenges. And I would anticipate our response time to that is very quick. And then when you start to talk about priority 2s, I think when we begin to kick up those numbers across the city, and some of the things I think that fall into the priority 2 category, for instance, would be like ShotSpotter. So you have a ShotSpotter alert, corresponding 911 call. Maybe it's not even connected to like a hotspot or a P&I location. That's something that that may fall in the priority order, and the response to that may be significantly delayed.
Thank you. I would like to see the data by police district at some later point, but before budget comes to us for approval. Southwest Denver's district had the longest response time in Auditor Gallagher's report in 2013, 2014, and we managed to reduce that. But in my part of town, it's much harder to get around.
Yeah.
It's hard to get south of Hamden. There's only two ways to get there. If there's an emergency south of Hamden, so I would like to see that broken down. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I will say, just to put a fine point on that, I will say too that beginning in November of 2022, we reorganize our staffing plan by workload, and so I think the districts are much better organized from a staffing perspective. I would expect to see response time numbers be quite similar across districts.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Councilman Cashman, you are up now, and afterwards is Councilwoman Alvarez.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chief, thanks for the presentation. With the backdrop that the department continues to operate at below authorized strength, it is certainly encouraging that we become a bit of a leader in alternative response with civilian crash investigators and STAR and co-responders to minimize the need for badge and gun. You, in July, further reduced the need for men and women in blue with a new policy designed to minimize low-level pretextual traffic stops. I'm wondering if there are other areas of opportunity to continue that trend in alternative response.
Certainly. I think that we can always continue to bolster our efforts as it relates to reports that can be taken online, reports that can be taken by civilians, whether they be burglary reports or other property crime reports. I think that our accident report takers have been quite successful, and so I think that continuing to look at that as a way to reduce workload for our gun and badge carrying force, I think is a good way to go.
Thank you for that. I'm guessing it's too early to have any data regarding the low-level stops policy. When would you guess might be a reasonable time to expect a first look at that?
Well, I'd have to talk to people that are much smarter about data than I am to get that answer. But what I can tell you is that it may be difficult to parse out the impact that it is having to maybe lower our response times, because we have officers that instead of engaging in low-level traffic stops are available to respond to calls. It might be difficult to really parse that out, but I do believe, just looking at the data that I have seen, that it does make sense to focus officers on those that are much more important.
Thank you so much. Next up is Councilwoman Alvidrez, followed by Councilwoman Torres.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chief. It's always good to see you. I'll start off with, I see a 6 FTE decrease in police investigations, and I'm curious what that means. And if that's made up somewhere else.
I think we can find it here pretty quick in the budget book.
I think what you're seeing there is some of the reductions. Keep the page. Some of the positions that are being held vacant that are civilian positions in the police department. And I think it's mainly on 6th, and there are different classifications.
Right, and I think to address like where they are in terms of, like I think in investigations is where you said they were. I think that those are crime scene technicians and real-time crime center technicians. And so, again, no front-facing impact there, just a need for us to sort of reprioritize and restructure our work schedules in order to make sure that the shifts are covered that need to be covered.
I appreciate that. I think where I come from, it's just a level of concern. There was a shooting on my block in March, still hasn't been solved. There's the DC's person that came out of the waterway on Spear, still haven't gotten updates. And so when I'm talking about homicide, I'm very concerned about those being resolved. And I think that's always our highest priority. And I'm speaking as like a brand new council member with only 1 year of experience, but when I see those things, it's very concerning to me. So I want to share that that concern with you. Another question I have around training is, when it comes to training, what kind of certification for target practice type of activities is there?
So we shoot for qualification twice a year, and everyone must achieve a score of 90% or better, and it's even more significant than that. So there is a target, and if you miss the target, so in essence, if you miss the target and provide an opportunity to hit someone downrange, then that's an automatic failure, and so you would have to retake it. And so there's a significant focus on hitting your target at distances both short and long. And so, again, with 90% accuracy in terms of hitting the target, but anything that's off of the silhouetted target is an automatic failure.
I appreciate that, and I will just say I'm concerned with them being able to practice. What I've been told is that they don't have, we don't provide ammunition, and I know that's really expensive, but I am concerned about that. So I will give it back to Madam Chair.
I would question that. There's plenty of ammunition, plenty of opportunities for people to train. I mean, while we require people to shoot for qualification twice a year, the range is open all the time. People can come down and practice whenever they please. So there is plenty of opportunities for people who don't maybe feel confident in their skills to brush up on that.
All right, great. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Next, Councilwoman Torres, followed by Councilwoman Sawyer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chief.
Yes.
P&I is what I'm going to ask about. 95% reduction for Paco Sanchez does not mean a 95% improvement in the P&I area. So one of the things that I want to ask for is if we could get a full briefing on, you know, we're what are we, 6 months out, Chief, from this starting, and where we're at and what's happening. That's just, I think, a major request that I've got.
Sure.
Visibly, what I see is movement back and forth where Mariposa and Colfax, I feel like, is the new drain of resources for police response for, but I don't know the data. And so a 95% reduction in gun-related crimes, we had 8 coming out of 2023. So I think 0 or less than 1, I think, is amazing so far in 2024. But we had other problems that were creating that P&I. So what are those and how are we improving them is my request.
Sure, and I think you can anticipate that briefing very quickly. What I can share is that while we have seen some displacement of drug activity that you're well aware of, we have not seen significant displacement of violent crime.
The other question is around resources shifting between districts. I know the HOT team has increased in District 1, and I applaud that. They've needed that. But I don't know if there are other things that are shifting between districts, so just some more information later would be great.
Yes. So every district has their own HOT team. Obviously, District 6, who has the bulk of the problem, has probably the largest and most well-versed in terms of resources and things like that. But I think all of our other HOT teams across the city, I think, are getting that education and getting that understanding of all the resources, because that is their primary responsibility, is to provide that resource and outreach to members of the community that are experiencing homelessness.
So I think, Mayor, my question is, only $250,000 is going into P&I, as the budget says, but it's going to parks and recreation. It's going for lighting. So I'd like to understand what other improvements have been needed or recommended through the work that's been done so far, because more than that is going to be required for the 5 locations, and more if there are more that get added in the coming year.
Fair comment. The only thing that I'd add additionally to that is that there are things that are occurring, not just in Paco Sanchez, but in other P&I locations that are just being absorbed by that agency's existing budget. It's really more of a reprioritization, understanding that P&I locations are of higher importance, I think, because of the challenge that it presents to the community. So I think often we're doing what we had planned to do with existing dollars, just kind of reprioritizing when these things occur.
Council stories that is also the 25 expenditure in the 2024 budget line for P&I. We had closer to $1 to $2 million, I think, of dollars moving together this year.
$1.2 million has been spent already.
Yeah, a lot of this paid off in this year's budget. This is a kind of maintenance carry forward in 25.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, Councilwoman Sawyer, you are up, and following is Councilman Watson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, you guys are amazing. Thank you so much. A special shout out to Districts 2 and 3, who do an incredible job over in Council District 5. It's really hard in this budget book because we don't see programmatic budgeting, right? So you've touched on it a little bit, but, and maybe this is a safety committee presentation, it would be really valuable to understand what the true 2025 investment in P&I locations is, because some of that's in Dottie, some of that's in parks, some of that's in a couple of other different places. None of it is in here in the DPD section, and that is very difficult for us to then understand what the real impact and investment in 2025 will be in those locations. So that's probably a follow-up for safety committee, but if we could do that, that would be really helpful. And then, so I think, having spent a lot of time in this space, the two most successful programs we have when it comes to fighting crime prevention side of the work that you do is P&I and the LPR technology. I noticed on here that there's a little bit more for the LPR technology, but not a lot. Curious. And I don't, again, this might be a safety committee briefing, but are we taking a look at some of the other technology contracts we have and considering maybe spending those dollars differently on things that we know are working better when it comes to the technologies we want to fill the gap between, our residents and the police, given you're still unfortunately low staffing numbers.
Sure, I appreciate the question. So we have about 95 of our LPR cameras that are installed now. I think our target is 111. And we've been kind of ramping up for a number of months to get to the point where we're at now. So I expect that once we get that 111 installed, which will be supported, the contract supported by the $390,000. I think that, you know, that we were very pragmatic, I think, in the locations of those cameras. And so I don't know that a significant investment in more cameras is necessary. I think that we will continue to see impacts through, you know, recovery of vehicles much more quickly, solving of crimes much more quickly. I think we will continue to see that. Where I do see opportunities to leverage technology, certainly in, you know, boosting our online capabilities so that people can complete reports online. Again, our drone technology, I think, is something that is going to be very helpful to us, you know, being able to, again, you know, I think we all talk about, you know, providing the best response, and I think that leverages that opportunity very significantly by getting over, you know, over top and being able to identify exactly what resource, if any, is the most appropriate.
Okay, I appreciate that. I will say, for example, there's not a flock camera at the District 5 P&I location. So that feels like a little bit of a miss. I know there were almost 50 city employees who were out there last Wednesday, including me and my staff. And that was one of the things we brought up with the property owner as a request for the property owner to pay for to put it in if it wasn't going to be included in our budget. I think that's the least they could do. But I do think that we need to kind of align a little bit more what those locations are, you know, now that they're in and the program has shown to be so successful.
Yeah, again, appreciate the input, but I will say that those 111 locations were the 111 locations that had the highest propensity for violence, stolen cars, hit and runs. And so they were, again, very thoughtfully, I think, identified. Maybe we can take another look just to see what might, there might even actually be something that is close to that P&I location that at least is capturing vehicles as they come or go.
Okay, thanks. Thanks, Madam Chair. Great. Yes, please.
My councilman, just to add to that quickly, because I shared your same urgency here. When we first talked about this last year, the idea was came to us with like a let's do 20 more license plate readers. And I'd asked what would full deployment citywide look like, and that was the 111 number. So rather than doing 20 a year for 5 years, we said let's do all 111 this year. That was meant to get us to full operations. There may still be gaps in that net, but this is not kind of step one of three. Yeah. It was meant to be the full map deployed as fast as possible. So okay. Now we can just troubleshoot spaces we might have missed.
Yeah, awesome, thanks.
Yeah.
Great. So I have 5 members in the queue, and we have just a little, almost about 15 minutes left, so I want to make sure we get to everyone. Next is Councilman Watson, followed by Councilwoman Parody.
Thank you, Committee Chair. Chief Thomas, and to your leadership team, and the teams within Denver Police Department, thank you so much for the work that you've done, not only across the city, but in Fine District 9. Your work specifically with District 6, District 2, District 1 police for our encampment resolution, ensuring that we provide stable shelter for folks, has been a lifesaver for those folks and a lifesaver for the businesses and communities surrounding District 9, especially Ballpark and Five Points. I have 2 quick questions for you, sir. On Chief Thomas, I'm reading my question. Chief Thomas, on page 642, what trainings will be reduced or eliminated because of this 5% cut? And how will the reduction in trainings affect BPD and our community from your perspective? I don't know if I said 52.
642?
Yeah, on page 642. What trainings will be reduced or eliminated? There's a 5% cut. How will those reductions in trainings, from your perspective, impact DPD and our community? And that's the last line on 642, is right above expenditures by activity total.
Okay. I'd have to get back on you to understand exactly what that that reduction is. I can tell you that there is going to be no reduction in anything that is significant. We are still going to be training people in use of force, crowd control. I mean, all of the things that that I think that you have seen that have where there have been mistakes that have cost the city money. I think we're going to maintain our training there.
I'm very curious on that answer, so I look forward. We'll send that to Angela to get a response. On page 638, you see a slight reduction, reduction in number of recruits in 2025. My curiosity was piqued this morning around recruitment after learning and hearing in one of the briefings that there are about your cannabis use process and disqualifying recruits because of that that process. So I'm curious from your perspective or the leaders of the recruitment team or HR process, can you describe your criteria for cannabis use for recruits and compare that to what your criteria is for alcohol use and a disqualification of recruits based on that?
We were talking to Chief about the civil service commission. The process for vetting candidates, and the fire department raised one of those challenges is the requirement to attest to previous marijuana use. And I was adding that you have both that plus a polygraph that someone has to take additionally as an officer that is a disqualifier. And so we were just talking about marijuana policy as a challenge for the pipeline.
So the marijuana policy is currently 1 year, no use. Used to be five. It's been reduced to 1 year. I think that that might be prudent to look at reducing that to no use post test, because I think that it's a legal substance to use. Certainly, we don't want members of the department using that substance. But I think that a 1 year requirement when someone makes up their heart and mind to become a police officer might be unreasonable.
And I'll just say, Chief Tomlinson, I'll turn it back to the committee chair. I think without data behind the why for that, cannabis is legal within the city and county of Denver. So that's a little bit of a preamble. Would love to see the data behind the why. It doesn't make sense to me.
Well, it doesn't make sense to change the requirement. Is that true?
It makes sense to change it, but existing doesn't make sense.
So, and I think that probably would have to be obtained through civil service. I know that they do identify and break down by race the reason why people were kicked out by certain disqualifiers.
Yeah, very helpful, sir. Thank you, committee chair.
Thank you.
Add for future briefings, the two most discriminatory factors we have right now in the recruiting of high-quality officers are, one, that requirement, and the second, the current testing requirement, which disproportionately excludes people of color with no connection to actual qualifications or performance on the job.
And that's my point. Thank you, sir. Thank you, committee chair.
Great. Thank you. So just so folks that are listening in or following along, we do have more than 15 minutes. I'm trying to keep everybody on their toes and make sure that we don't go far beyond. But with that said, Councilwoman Parity, you are up with Councilwoman Gilmore to follow.
Thank you so much for being here and for all the information, Chief. So first question I have is about the new idea of trust patrols. I'm chewing on this because it's 400 patrols in 2025 when we have response time is the biggest concern, you know, of residents, and as we can see, it's a valid concern. I'm just really chewing on that as a use of time for patrol officers. And in particular, if you look at the form on the website, and I've sort of seen different descriptions of what these are intended to be, so I'm interested to hear that more precisely. But it looks like there's something that primarily can be requested by businesses. And so if it's intended to be sort of like a, you know, responsive to business owners who we often hear from quite loudly and rightfully, but we hear from business owners loud and clear a lot of the time, probably more than we do from a lot of other residents. It feels a little bit like a concierge, like designed to sort of placate businesses kind of thing. And I just don't know about it as a use of officer time in the environment that we're in. So I would like to hear your thoughts.
Sure.
So first let me say that the 400 number actually is what we anticipate getting to this year. So I would anticipate our number in 2025 once all three phases have been fully rolled out. I expect that number to be higher. But that is actually during uncommitted time. So, you know, we're not having officers that are not responding to calls because they're stuck on a trust patrol. You know, these are engagements that occur when, you know, during time that's uncommitted. And certainly if they are out on a trust patrol, we've already had these discussions with Denver 911. If they are not on a trust patrol and there's a need for an officer to respond on a call for service, then they're going to be called and asked to respond to that. So I don't see that having an impact on our response times. I just think it's one more opportunity for us to have a positive interaction with the community. And while certainly it may seem like it's been developed to check in on businesses, the way that it's been detailed to our officers is that there are a lot of things that they have historically done, I think, can be deemed as a trust patrol. For instance, you know, I have a number of officers that I know will see kids kicking a soccer ball or shooting a basketball or throwing a football, and will take a few moments to get out of their car and engage with those young people. And so I think that it's really just the impromptu opportunity to engage, whether it's with a community member or a neighborhood group or business, is what makes up our trust patrols. And again, because these are things that are being engaged in during times that's not committed to a call for service, I don't think that it has an impact on that at all.
Thank you for that. And I mean, I think nonetheless, I can think of even during times when people aren't being called out to an emergency call, I can think of a lot of ways for that officer time to be used. So how much uptake has there been on that submission form? Like, how often are you getting requests for these?
I have to check with the team on that.
Awesome. Thank you for that. And then the other area of questions that I have involves the academy. So over the course of the year, we've just had really a number of concerning incidents coming out of either the academy or officers who had recently graduated from the academy. So, of course, we've read in the news about what happened to Victor Moses. That was tragic, but some of the details around understanding that these are allegations, but some of the details from witnesses and things like that around like fight day, I have concerns about. In our last OIM report, we had multiple incidents of more senior officers sexually harassing female cadets. There was a text chain among a recent academy class group, so they formed as a like group chat when they were in academy together. They had graduated, where they were joking about shooting migrants. That was reported by someone who had resigned, not by anyone who was still an active employee, which is also really concerning to me. We heard concerns from the former civil service head about allowing an applicant who didn't pass a psych evaluation to continue into academy. So that package of things has me very, very concerned about the academy. And in particular, when we look at this slide deck and we're intentionally trying to recruit more women, more, you know, young people of color into that environment, I just really question that, especially after reading that OIM report. I just hate to be proactively, you know, trying to recruit young women into an environment where that's like what was reported and came out of discipline. It just really gives me pause. So I'm interested to know how you're trying to respond to that sort of package of things, because it's sort of a lot in my mind.
Thank you. Let me try to unpack that. So I will say that in response to some of the issues occurring, first of all, it's actually not called Fight Day. It's a dynamic action drill that has been vetted twice by POST, and they approved of the drill. We actually have improved the drill ourselves, just because we have seen officers have minor injuries as a result of that. So we've actually made some enhancements to that ourselves. Again, having Colorado Post observe that, I'm as concerned as you about the treatment of women on our police department. I think that we have done a pretty good job doing three citywide trainings of respectful workplace interactions. We have seen a drastic drop in our EEO complaints from a high of 10 in 2022 to, I think, one so far this year and three last year. So I think that our efforts there to create a much more welcoming environment for women has been successful. I too was concerned about the fact that we only learned that troubling behavior by those three recruits by someone who had already separated from the job. As you saw, I swiftly acted upon that, and understanding that there were several other members of the department that did observe the post, didn't react to it, but also didn't act upon it, and understand that is an expectation. We have sent them all through ABLE refreshers, so ABLE being active leadership in law enforcement, with the understanding that the expectation is that when you see somebody do something wrong, even if it's just a little wrong, your responsibility is to call that out and stop somebody from making a mistake.
I really appreciate all of those responses and everything that you're doing from the top down, and I just worry that it can be really hard to dislodge those kinds of elements of any organization once they're there. So definitely, you know, calls for ongoing conversation, but I've just been really struck by the amount of incidents that sort of relate to the academy and to the, you know, the classes coming out of it. So thank you for that answer.
Yeah, in fairness, that OIM report was reporting on incidents that occurred over a year ago. And so I would like to say that things have improved quite significantly since then.
Because as we've discussed, the matrix leads to a 10-day suspension, so.
Yeah, and I mean, I won't go into all of the circumstances. I think that generally we agree on, in terms of, the power structure, and I think that that those also were not disciplinary decisions that I made, I think that you and I are aligned on how serious that conduct is.
I think so too, and I appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Thank you, Councilwoman Parity. Next is Councilwoman Gilmore, followed by Pro Tem Romero Campbell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Chief Thomas, thank you for the presentation and all the work that you and your officers are doing in the community. I had a question about the decrease that's proposed on page 642, and you're probably familiar there because you just did the training decrease. I'm looking at the Community Relations and Public Affairs Fund, and it looks like it's going to be reduced by about 36%, and I just wanted to understand what activities wouldn't be happening with the reduction of that Community Relations and Public Affairs Fund.
So public affairs would basically be our community, our public information office, and the community relations would be, I think, staff that had previously supported our community relations division, but I anticipate actually seeing greater community relations work and community engagement because of the infusion of those three new community engagement program managers that I understand won't be immediate, but by mid-year, I think that we will be able to take advantage of all six of them, and the three of them, I think, are doing extraordinary work.
Okay. I appreciate that. I guess I'm just trying to understand, is that decrease, is that money then going to be moved over for the community engagement positions?
So I think the decrease, Council Person, that you're seeing is holding eight positions vacant in that cost center, which are positions that we would work with DPD on if there were to be a new vacancy that were to occur mid-year next year, that is a lower priority to fill than one of these positions. And so I think that's what's driving that big decline, is holding some of the positions in that cost center.
Okay. All right. I appreciate that answer. I might send you a follow-up with Angela and Tim on that one. Thank you for that. And then my second question is, I was going to ask you about drones, but I won't ask you about that because I would like to understand and make a request of you, Chief Thomas and Mayor Johnston, you know, monthly Councilman Cashman and I receive the Department of Safety monthly discipline orders. And so we have asked to receive that information in talking with Julia Richmond and the Citizens Oversight Board. And so we get that those reports every month. Is there a report out quarterly or mid-year, a high-level synopsis of what the top five disciplinary orders might be for the Department of Safety? Do we have any tracking mechanism such as that? And if we do, that would be really great to share a little bit more with City Council, just so that we know what's happening and what's going on.
So I, if I'm following, you're talking about like the
departmental orders.
But the specifics as it relates, like the specific charges that these officers are being found sustained for. So we actually do a quarterly trend review to identify what trends there are. So, you know, we have identified that maybe there are trends with people maybe having failing to recognize First Amendment issues or Fourth Amendment issues. Could be, not doing proper searches and introducing people in the jail that have contraband and things like that. And so we do that trend review, identify those trends, and then build training around that so that we can make sure that we start to eliminate those mistakes. And I think that we can certainly share with you what trends we're seeing in terms of sustained cases and what it is that we're doing about it.
Appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. Next, I have Council Pro Tem Romero Campbell, followed by Councilwoman Lewis.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Chief Thomas, for your partnership and everything that you and your entire team have done with us over this past year. Has been really, I think, very responsive in District 4 and helping us navigate some really challenging conversations, especially with the opening of a new family shelter. So I just appreciate that partnership. Some of my questions have been asked, so I will just add on. I think as Councilmember Gilmore had asked about the community relations and public affairs, in the budget, it seems as though there still is education that's needed from general public as to what number to call, as to who to call for what they are experiencing, right? So people, when you call 911, you want somebody to show up or you want somebody to respond. But is there anything in the budget that is a education or awareness for residents to know, like, I hear music in the park. I hear, you know, I see somebody driving without a license plate. Or expired tags. I mean, you name it down the list. As to how they can go through a process to, one, report that and who to name.
Sure. So let me give you a couple responses. So one, I think that Justin called out, I think that if you look in your appendix, you'll actually see all of the positions that are being frozen, and actually none of them, I think, are related to community relations. I think that's just the cost center that money savings is coming from. So something that I think the budget understands that I really don't. What I do understand is that those 43, 44 positions that we are holding vacant will have no significant public-facing impact and will have no impact on our ability to engage positively with our community. Now, as it relates to helping people better understand what mechanism to get the appropriate police response, I mean, I think that that's something that is regularly discussed at district cab meetings. I think it's something that is discussed at when we are present at RNO meetings. I think we could probably get one of our community engagement program managers to probably put together like a refrigerator magnet or something like that to help people better understand that if it's something that you think that a police response right now is going to stop the situation, call 911. If it's more informational, that the non-emergency number would be more appropriate, or if it's something that's more, you know, sort of neighborhood specific, that it might be better to reach out to the district commander or the district CRO. So I think that we can certainly put together some literature or some sort of thing that people can retain that would help them understand that better.
Thank you. Thanks. I appreciate that and would love to continue the conversation, because I think that is something that, you know, they don't know who else to call, and so now they're emailing and calling our office as well, and we just aren't always sure where to direct them. There was a program, and I know, and I appreciate the data that you have been using to inform your decision making, and we've seen it not only through car thefts and reduction, I think through P&I, et cetera. But I really do wonder, it was brought to our attention from a resident about a program similar to what they have in Boulder of being able to identify or have a sticker that you put on the windshield of a car that will tell you if someone in the vehicle has a learning disability or somewhere on the spectrum or has some cognitive delay that, I'm not saying it right, but that has, that would need additional attention. So if somebody goes up, then you would know inside the car that there is an individual that may have a delayed response or have a different, you know, response to that traffic stop. And I don't know if that is something that the department would be interested in looking at or further investigating, just so that we can make sure as people are getting stopped, they can.
Well, I think it's a great idea. I mean, you know, obviously we have all of our officers are CIT trained, so they're sort of trained to identify some of those cues, whether they be cognitive issues or hearing issues or something like that. But I think, you know, creating some sort of a sticker or decal that would illustrate that, you know, upon approach to the car before maybe a conversation to identify some of those details, I think would be a great idea.
Thank you. Appreciate that, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Of course. Next up, Councilwoman Lewis.
Thank you. The first question is about the community-based crime reduction program. I see it about doubles, and so I'm curious as to what is that program, and how are those dollars going to be invested back into the communities to prevent crime?
What page, Councilperson, are you looking
at? Oh, yeah, you never heard it. I'm sorry. We are on page 643.
643. Mm-hmm. And about where on the page? Sorry.
Mm-hmm. I assume that's our reduction program. Do you
community-based.
My understanding is where we have community-based crime reduction grant monies being applied is in Police District 4 in the Westwood neighborhood. And I can only imagine, I mean, I can check into this deeper, but I can only imagine that this is just the way the monies were supposed to be allocated based upon the way that grant was written. But my understanding is that the only place that we are employing that strategy and using grant money is in the Westwood neighborhood in District 4.
Can you follow up with what that strategy is? I just have no idea what.
Yeah, I can help you with that. I can send you an entire report on what that all entails. It's actually even longer term strategy than P&I, because I think it's been running for a number of years.
Okay.
I think the grant does run out here fairly soon.
Okay. With that report, I would love to know about like the success metrics as well, if it's been a long running program. So thank you. This may be a question for you, this could be a question for the mayor, and I'm getting back in the queue because I have a third question. You mentioned that the test and marijuana were the two barriers for being able to recruit diverse classes of police recruits, and I'm curious is what is the data that you all have to support that? Like, do you track if someone fails a test, either drug test or whatever, and then you split that up by race?
So fair question. So that data is actually compiled by civil service, and they do share that with us. And so what I can tell you is that there is, you know, we know how many people of various races sign up for the test, ultimately complete the test, passed the test, all again broken down by race. And what I have identified is that there's a lot of people that don't even finish the test or don't even take the test. And a significant number of those are people of color. I suspect that that is because there is a barrier, because there's a cost associated with that. And civil service actually has just recently been comfortable in waiving that cost. And so we're hoping that
across the board?
Across the board, hoping that, that the removal of that barrier will help with an influx of people of color. And the other thing that I have identified having taken a sample test is that there are questions that I believe have disparate impact depending on what your cultural experience has been, and what your understanding of your legal responsibility and your responsibility as a police officer is. So I think it's heavily weighted towards people who may have already been a police officer versus people that are just good people that we're looking for to serve in our communities.
So more specifically about the actual test than about the marijuana usage.
Well, I mean, I would say that there is an identified impact on the marijuana being a barrier.
Okay.
Not as stark an impact as we believe some implicit bias in the test.
Okay.
Thank you.
We do have deep data. We had an outside partner do an analysis on the pipeline, the funnel. How many people start at the beginning of the process, and how many people get at the end, and where do they drop out? And that subdivided by race, and overwhelmingly the biggest cutoff is the test. I'll add also, it is more than 500 questions long, which is more than three times the length of the law school entrance exam. And so with no demonstrated link to long-term performance, so the Sheriff's Department moved to a different test we've been employing now. You'll see that as a department that's had the most successful expansion of their recruit classes and expansion of the diversity of those classes. We think there are other tests that would be more effective, shorter, and not discriminatory that could be used instead of the one we have now, but this one we have now I think is a real obstacle.
I'd be curious to see that analysis that you all have access to, and maybe it comes to safety, I don't know, but I'm just curious of it if it's good.
Yeah, I'd be happy to share it with you.
All right, I'm rounding out our first round and we have time for a second round, it looks like, maybe. Okay, so going off of that, Chief and Mayor, I didn't see you. Oh my God. Okay, you go next. You go now.
She said, I'm going to cut out Sandoval.
No, you go.
She
you
said,
go.
I'm sad.
Don't be sad.
I didn't see you.
I think I'm in there.
You are there. I saw
you. She's in the party. Oh, yeah, you did. Your turn. Your turn.
Thank you. Thank you, Chief. I just want to say thank you for all the years that I've known you. I think it's great to have you in the leadership position. So just want to say that on the record. So on page is it here? On page 638 of the budget book, it talks about all of, so there's this narrative that we keep defunding the police, and I just don't think that's accurate. I think it's shown on page 638 more comprehensively than I've ever seen it. So number of bad recruits in 2021 is 105, 2022 is 184. 2024, this year will be actually 167 because we added three, and in 2025, 168. So of those numbers, let's just go back from to 2023, how many actually graduated out of those recruit classes? Do you know, if you don't have that number, if you could get it to us?
Yeah, I can get it to you. Hard for me to overlook a Northsider, so. But I will say that, yes, we do track the numbers that ultimately graduate from the academy and are successful in the training program, so I can share that with you.
Okay, and then in the appendix on slide 27, you're keeping six photo enforcement vacant for the 2025.
Yes.
Is there any correlation between keeping those vacant and having speeding? Because one of the major things that we get in Northwest Denver is, and I think throughout the city, is speeding. And I think it has a direct correlation with our Vision Zero. So we want to have, like, safe streets and dotting, and we want to have bike lanes everywhere, which all my colleagues know that they're getting hit up on my neighborhood bike lane right now as we speak. How does that impact those? And you don't have to do that for me right now, but I do find it interesting that we have these goals and yet we're keeping those 6-foot enforcement vacant. And then my last question, I did have one more question. During our fire department briefing, they talked about how they had a civil service committee. So I think civil service committee, yeah. So does the police department have a group of people who are looking at this civil service, like the charter language? Because I know that Council Morris and I, for like a couple of years now, have wanted to convene together with the administration a lot of what we're talking about, because a lot of these testing, a lot of the biases that are on these tests, to the mayor's point, are baked into charter and they can't be updated. And so as you sit here in front of all of us, that is something that I would love to take on, but it feels daunting to take it on unless you have like maybe a committee that is looking at the civil service and looking at the charter and what could actually be updated, and having an analysis of other cities that have that and like what are best practices, so then we could take that on the legislative side, because that would be a big ballot question to go to the residents of Denver.
So I paid quite a bit of attention to how the mayor will take a table order of 12 and be able to get that order correct and answer all those questions. So let me give it a shot myself. So as far as photo radar, yes, we are holding vacant 6 photo radar positions of the 15 total that we have. Quite frankly, we've had a difficult time filling all 15 of those positions. And so while we are authorized for 15, we haven't had all 15 for over a year. It's just a difficult position to fill and keep filled. The other thing that I will say is that while I think their mission and their values, I think, are very similar to Vision Zero, they're actually not as as maybe they could be, because Vision Zero, I think, primarily focuses on state highways, and those photo enforcement vans really are only allowed by policy to be deployed on residential streets near schools, and so there are no state highways in those locations where they're deployed. I will say that, you know, understanding that we don't have the full complement of 15, we do, I think, make some very prudent decisions on where they are deployed. Listening to, I think, information from council officers like yourself, community members, and other things like that, and also understanding the importance of our school zones. And then lastly, with civil service, I am actually quite hopeful with the new director. I've actually met with her a number of times. She seems to be very energetic and very interested in removing barriers and doing some process improvement. To the point where I think that we can realize our goals. I think that she will. I think she's already agreed to work with our peak improvement folks with the city, and she may even identify some things in charter that need to be changed to be even more helpful towards helping us all reach our goals.
And incorporate Peak Academy. So thank you for doing that, because we could look at DFD, GPD, and look at the charter and incorporate Peak Academy. Thank you. Thank you for saying that, Chief.
I'm sorry, Council. I'm not going to be able to live that down. Okay. I have a couple questions myself, and I just want to kind of go off of the questions around the testing and the civil service process. So I guess I just wanted some clarity of whether or not if it is in fact the test, or is it the cost of the test? And with that, do we have, like, aside from Chief, taking the test yourself, do we have like validated analysis of the test and whether it is actually discriminatory? I think I would just be curious to know all of those pieces. So if it's the test, the cost, is it discriminatory? Do we have that information?
So I think we are doing an analysis to identify all of those answers. I do believe that the cost is a barrier. I do believe that the significant length of the test is a barrier, which is why I think a lot of people start the test and don't complete it. You know, they started it on their lunch hour is over, they got to get back to work. And so I think that those are significant barriers. Again, having taken the test and seeing some of the questions that are asked, that I think, based upon your cultural experience, you may have a different response. I do think that there are concerns there. Those are things that I've already shared with the director, because I think that she's looking keenly at herself.
Great. My last question is around, some folks have brought up the training stuff, and on not only on page 642, but also on page 644, where it shows the FTEs for training. And if we're looking at three recruit classes, and since 2023, we had 35 FTE, we're down to 29 FTE, but we're trying to do three classes. And I keep, at least during the 101 that we did with DPD, there was a slide, I recall, a couple slides around recruitment and how that has been on the rise and increase, actually, in fact, since 2020, which I was surprised to see, because I was told that with, you know, Senate Bill 217, that we would see a decline in people wanting to be law enforcement officers, but in fact, that showed something different. But with that said, I just want to know how we're going to accomplish these classes, these academies, with fewer training FTEs.
So again, I think that's just confusion brought on by the fact that monies are taken from a cost center that may seem to associate with training, but there's been no trainers removed from the academy. We've not reduced our number of trainers. We've actually increased our number of trainers at the academy. We trained a class of 57 in April of 2023, and so we are well suited to train three classes of 56 in 2025.
Thank you so much. We have a little bit of time left, and I have Councilwoman Alvidrez and Councilwoman Lewis back in the queue. Did anybody else ping me just so that I make sure I didn't miss you? Okay. Hey, I've been doing this all day. So we'll go to Councilwoman Alvidrez and then Councilwoman Lewis to round it out.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Chief. I was wondering, I mean, I think it's great that we have all these cameras for license plates, but I'm sure other offices also get these complaints about we're not enforcing not having a license plate at all. And so there seems to be an imbalance in priorities there. If we're investing in that, why aren't we requiring people to have a license plate?
Well, we do require people to have license plates, and we do enforce people that drive without a license plate. So just for clarification, driving without a law enforcement, without a license plate, is not something that I would consider to be low priority. I would consider that to be high priority, because I think that there's reason to believe that car is stolen, doesn't belong to the driver, and so I would expect an officer to make that stop on a vehicle that doesn't have a license plate. Now, if we have a vehicle that the license plate has been expired for a week, I think that's different. But I will, call attention to the fact that when we did have that 30-day period where we adjusted our policy to allow for stops for that particular violation, we did see tickets written. What was more impressive is that we saw a 30% increase in the number of people that actually register their vehicles. So I think that the point of educating the public that we are going to start enforcing this again, I think to do the right thing and register their cars. And I anticipate doing that.
Great, I appreciate that. I also didn't get to shout out districts 3, 4, and 6 that are all doing great work. And then lastly, I'm really excited about the police e-bikes. And I'm curious if there's any plans or if there's any potentiality for vehicles for police officers.
Yeah, so we do have a complement of e-bikes, e-motorcycles that we have in probably half of our police districts. We have about 60 hybrid vehicles within our department. I think we are on pace to have a couple of true EVs. Difficulty there is right now we don't have the infrastructure to support full electrification of our force. We certainly want to be good partners, and we will continue to look for assignments that can support.
Great. I did hear that a police officer was super excited for the e-bikes to track down all the other people on the scooters and other bikes and get into places they might not. So, thank you, Madam Chair.
Of course. Thank you. Councilwoman Lewis, you're rounding us out here.
Okay, cool. Question, and this is on page, all right, Justin, here we go, 644. So what is the Smart Policing Initiative? And is that spelled wrong, or is that...
Right. We're missing a G.
Okay. I thought y'all were trying to be cool, you know, like police it or something. I don't know.
We're not cool. Okay. I think there should be some more details on, maybe that's in the grants section.
Okay.
So in the grants section of the budget book, the Denver Police Department has a whole bunch of different grants, and I'm not familiar with that specific one. Bear with me as I...
I can take it as a follow-up, too, if the chief just wants to send it to me about what it is. I'm okay with that.
Oh, there we go.
It is actually a grant, and it is set up to just reduce violence and sustain community in certain sections. Uh-huh. So it is one of the grants that the police department has allowed.
Is it in a specific area? Is it just throughout the city? What do y'all? What does it do?
Smart. Of it, I don't know specific stuff. And so it's a P&I location.
Thank you. Seems yes. All right. We're going to get to it. Same page. Okay. Solving cold cases with DNA. 2023, we had 88,000. 2024, we had 224,000. 2025, zero. So we solved all the smart cases with DNA?
They, again, the grants, so it's the timing.
Let me get up out of here, Dave.
Some grants, the timing of them, like they may end in 2023. We have new grant awards that start in 24. And then some of the grant awards, where they may be extended at the time of budget publication, if we don't know that we've actually been funded and they've been through the council process or been through the formal contract approval process, we will not list them in the budget until that happens.
Understood. Okay. Then I don't even have to ask my next question because
you
answered it for me. Okay. I'm done. Appreciate y'all. Thanks for your work.
And maybe we can have, you know, a briefing on the smart policing initiative.
Every year forward, we're going to find one place in the budget to put police in just to see.
before I turn it over to the mayor, I know we heard a lot of good requests for things in safety committee, and we're keeping track of those. Angela is also helping me keep track of those so that we can get those. And I know a couple of those that we haven't had yet but have been on the board have been the trust policing and the hot streets. And those were things that I know when they came to Mayor's Council that we had asked for. And I think we're just kind of waiting to get them in. And then we have the P&I stuff as well.
Yeah, and maybe I should add the grant initiative that you pointed out, Smart Policing. It was a partnership between my office and DPD District 1 to put in lighting underneath the overpass, a federal boulevard at Paco Sanchez Park. So it's a very specific one, but super grateful for the work that DPD put into that grant application, and it was awarded. I think it was a state grant.
That's dope. Thank you so much. I appreciate that. Great. Well, with that, I'll turn it over to the mayor to wrap us up.
It was Council Torres' office that specifically requested taking off the G.
We are cool.
I just want to say a couple minutes of closing. I will say there's nothing more entertaining than requiring Chief Thomas to share really great news, because he gets so humble he just talks quieter and quieter. So I want to name a couple of things that I think were really noteworthy about the successes that his team have delivered, and you saw some of them, but I think the real proof that the strategies we're using are working that you all have supported. Obviously not done yet, but 40 to 95% reduction in shootings at the P&I sites in year one is a great step forward for us. Now over 2 years, 60% reduction in auto theft, because of the great work of the auto theft team, is remarkable. That program worked so well, I even tested it by getting my own car stolen, and turns out it really does work. So I wouldn't recommend that. The hot streets focus, I mean, 80% reduction, you may have heard that, in shootings in those places where we have elevated patrols on hot streets. Those are, and then this 30% citywide reduction in non-fatal shootings, plus, you know, safest year in downtown in 5 years. Those are all great signs. We're heading in the right direction, and so I just want to really thank the chief and his team for that. I think the one thing you notice about all of these is all of those responses require people. You know, they require officers that can be out on the streets and responding and present. That's why we focused on this expansion here. And the only thing I would just add on a personal note is, we sit together through all of the settlement hearings as a council, and so we get to hear all of the times where we have folks in any parts of the state that made bad decisions. And sometimes it can feel like an imbalanced view, I think, for me of what I see. And so I go also to the award ceremonies for the Denver Police Department, which I would invite you to come to sometime, because I was there last week. And just one of those fact patterns was, you may remember we had this 4 years ago at 622 Inca, where there was a guy who woke up one morning and decided to start shooting people riding bikes out of his house and shot multiple civilians who were walking and riding down the street. We had officers respond to that. First two officers that responded got shot on the way into that house trying to get that guy out. Then in the process of him barricading himself, he lights his house on fire. And so now fire has to respond to put out the fire this guy has set while he's barricading himself in his house shooting people. Fire can't get close enough for the hoses to work, so the four officers that were honored on Friday were the four officers who agreed to provide a human shield for the firefighter so he could get close enough to be able to get water onto this house, to put out the house of the guy that was trying to shoot them all the way through it. And so there are just remarkable moments every day that maybe don't make the news or don't make our briefing books, that are examples of incredible courage that this team executes every single day. One of the folks that responded to that situation is on my security detail. I've spent every day of the last year with them. Never once he told me that story. I probably wouldn't have if I didn't have to show up to the event where we happened to get honored. So I think that level of service, that level of humility, I think, is remarkable among your team, and I think your leadership of this team is what's showing that team gets such great results. So we are really excited with the progress. We know there's more to do, but just want to tell you how grateful we are to you and all your staff for what you've done for Denver.
Thank you, everybody. And with that, we will be back in about 13 minutes for Sheriff's.
About more round.